Oh, well, perhaps not. Well, then, Mr. Walls, can we put you on?
Sure.
All right, so we're going to do a house research of the accounts in this division, and I've asked our fiscal staff, Mr. John Walls, to walk us through those. And I suspect we've got info in the packet to pull out.
Mr. Chair, there is a spreadsheet that says public safety account overview in the folder. At some point, it should look like this. It's about a 4 or 5 page spreadsheet.
All right, so let's make sure all the members are there, including the chair. Is it behind us? All right, so if we're all, we all have the spreadsheet, then Mr. Walls.
Mr. Chair, I'll just run through this relatively quickly. This is for members who are new to the legislature. This is generally what our spreadsheets will look like, and I've included just a recent history of the last three biennia of appropriations are included in the spreadsheet to just give a little bit of recent history. So starting on the first page, sentencing guidelines has presented before. They're one of our major accounts, and they talked about the things that they do. One of their funding is all from the general fund, and they're currently receiving about a little less than $700,000 in their base. It's all general fund money. One of the key functions that they perform for the committee, though, is in doing fiscal notes for anything that would change a criminal penalty or create a new one, and it's their recommendations that set off the major costs for those bills. Mr. Chair, moving down to public safety, we have a few different areas in public safety. Public safety is split into two different committees. Transportation gets the transportation functions of transporting people or goods, and we get the functions of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, Fire Marshal, Board of Firefighter Training, Gambling and Alcohol Enforcement, Office of Justice Programs, which we'll present here in a little bit, Emergency Communications Networks, and then the other functions and the administration of public safety are housed in the other committee. On the top of the first page, where we see Public Safety, Homeland Security, and Emergency Management, they currently get about $4.2 million a year. The special revenue, most of that is in general fund. However, they do receive some environmental funds and special revenue funds. The special revenue funds of about $850,000 per year, which you can see on the top line in the far right, is for hazmat teams. That special revenue account is the fire safety account, and that comes from an assessment on insurance premiums. For the environmental fund, they get $72,000 a year. That is for keeping a hazardous materials database, and the rest of their funding is general fund. So moving to the next page, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. They've presented here before as well. They're receiving about $50 million a year in general fund money. They also receive about $2.3 million annually from the Trunk Highway Fund. As most of you know, the Trunk Highway Fund is made up of funds from both gas tax collections and I believe there's some license fee revenue in there as well. The $2.3 million a year is generally to do lab testing work on for arrests that were made on trunk highways, essentially by the State Patrol. Those can be DWI or drug seizure cases. Also, they receive $7,000 a year in state government special revenue funds, and those are for training purposes that they have. They do some training of other law enforcement agencies, and that's what those $7,000 a year are used for. Mr. Chair, moving down on line 60 to the fire marshal. Over the last few years, in the 14-15, 16-17 biennium, the fire marshal appropriation included appropriations for the Board of Firefighter Training, which is shown below beginning on line 72. Those were broken out as a separate appropriation beginning 2 years ago. Those funds, again, are 0.65% assessment on insurance premiums, and that those dollars are from the fire safety account. In the fire marshal, they will have dollars that are for inspections, but also for Task Force 1, air rescue, and 2 years ago we added for Medicaid senior living inspections. The Board of Firefighter Training below is now receiving about $5 million a year, again from the fire safety account, for firefighter training and education, some Task Force 1 dollars, and Minnesota Air Rescue Team. Mr. Chair, I made that confusing. The Task Force 1 and the Air Rescue were under Fire Marshal in previous bienniums. They're now down under the Board of Firefighter Training. Mr. Chair, moving up to the next part of the Department of Public Safety, gambling and alcohol enforcement, there is about $2.7 million a year that goes to gambling and alcohol enforcement. About 1.6 of that is from the general fund. There are special revenue fund dollars that are mixed into their appropriation. Of the $740,000 a year in special revenue fund, $70,000 of that is from the Gambling Control Board, and that is for electronic pull tab enforcement. And $700,000 of that is for from revenues and for inspections due to 2 a.m. bar close. Mr. Chair, moving down to the Office of Justice Programs, who will present here shortly, they have about $38 million a year in general fund and $96,000 a year from a state government special revenue fund. The $96,000 a year goes to parenting time centers, which tend to do supervised parenting visits or exchange of children where there's a contentious custody case. Moving down to line 122, emergency communications networks, about $77 million a year for the emergency communication networks throughout the state, 800 megahertz, and that comes from the 911 fees placed on telecommunications bills. So, Mr. Chair, the portions that we have of public safety amount to a little less than $200 million a year from all the various funds. The next account we would have is the Post Board on line 139. They receive special revenue funds, which are essentially a portion of the fees on criminal fines and surcharges are diverted to the Post Board. Recently, in 2018 and 19, they received $6 million a year in general fund for peace officer assistance training, and these were essentially one-time funds. I believe they sunset in 4 years. I think there was a $24 million total appropriation to do some increased peace officer training reimbursements through the Post Board with general fund. Mr. Chair, moving down to the Private Detectives Board, it's a smaller account, general fund, and they receive about $192,000 a year. Moving down to corrections, corrections is entirely funded from the general fund. They are split up into three areas: institutions, community services, and operations support. In institutions, would be all the funding for the food, the health care, and the pay of the guards and other needs of the institutions. That amounts to $426 million a year. In community services, the majority of the community services appropriation is for probation costs. They receive $130 million a year. 106 of that is for probation, both at the state and pass-through monies that flow to the counties. Mr. Chair, in operations support, this is their main office, their HR functions and other administrative functions of the agency, is about $28 million a year, again, all general fund, bringing corrections to about $585 million a year will be their base going into this biennium. There's also an annual transfer from the general fund to the community justice account. This was an account that was set up in the drug reform bill of 2 years ago. This money flows into this account and I believe is awarded to grantees through OJP, which we'll present here in just a few moments. The total amount of spending from all funds in our bill for the current fiscal year is $792 million. That'll be the starting point for this biennium when we get the governor's budget and what the governor chooses to add with available money in the forecast. Mr. Chair, I did want to add that what we're looking at here for all of these agencies are the dollars that we appropriate in the bill. There are other dollars that flow to these agencies that are federal funds, and they may have some internal funds that are statutory appropriations or open and standing appropriations. These might be, for example, the MNCOR account, which is an enterprise fund at Department of Corrections, where they have the authority to collect money from the products that they sell, but then they automatically have the ability to use them to pay the inmates who perform the work in those functions to buy supplies or new equipment. The federal funds, when we receive the budget books from the governor's budget, will list all of the federal funds that flow into each agency. At the back of that agency section, there will be a grant table for all of those federal funds and what their uses are. Primarily, those funds are appropriated by the federal government for specific functions. They are not discretionary funds and must be used for the purpose of which they are appropriated, so we have little say. The major exception to that, there's sometimes major grant pools, and OJP gets a major source of those grants. I believe the grants flowing into the OJP for several years, there are grants for fiscal 17 and 18 from the federal government totaling about $105 million. And those are somewhat discretionary to the state, and those are awarded by the Office of Justice Programs through a competitive process. But for the most part, we can't alter what federal funds are spent for. Mr. Chair, I hope that wasn't too confusing or rambling, and I'll answer any questions.
Not at all, Mr. Wells. I think they're very concisely well done. Are there any questions for our fiscal staff? Representative Chairman Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a few questions. If you can just explain briefly some of the significant increases proportionally. For instance, on line 12, the special revenue fund that jumps from, in the past biennium, $604,000 to $850,000. And what is the explanation for that 30-some-odd percent increase? And I've got a few other ones. If you'd rather just do them one at a time, that'd be great.
I'll just do them one at a time. Mr. Wall.
Mr. Chair, so if you – and Representative Dean, if you would look down to line 22, emergency response teams, that was a two-year increase, 346 the first year and 246 the second year. And so if you add the 246 to the base of 604, it adds to 850 on line 25, and then that carries forward up into the base for the next year. What I would say is that was, you know, that was an increase to the emergency response teams from the fire safety account. There had been money accumulating in those accounts that had been going unspent, and the legislature basically used those monies at the request of the firefighter training board to increase appropriations to certain things. And when those recommendations were funded, that became the new base funding, and there is ongoing receipts to support that that increase. I would say, as of note, that all things should follow from year to year, where you see at the end of the biennium something carry up to the top line of the next year. But if you look at the very top in sentencing guidelines, it goes from 604 up to 641. Sometimes there's an appropriation made in a bill outside the committee or an adjustment made. There can be transfers of certain functions or duties that come outside the bill that would increase the base for something else. Funding in a pension bill, for example, might go to an agency or some other function that another committee makes an appropriation for. And so the base may jump slightly, and it might not be explained by the spreadsheet. But I'm sorry, that was a little bit rambling as well.
Mr. Chair, that's why I have these questions, to try to understand them a little better. When I also then look at line 32, I believe it is, under the BCA, in the previous fiscal year it was 47.9 and 42.5, and it jumps to $50.8 million. And I'm trying to discover that in the additional lines and carrying forward. Do you recall what that increase?
What line again?
32.
32.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to interrupt.
Mr. Chair and Representative Dean, off the top of my head, I don't remember exactly what this relates to. However, there are certain things that are hidden on this spreadsheet. And there were certain years where we did, through language in a bill rider, saying that an agency may receive $1 million for something in years 16 and 17, but the base would be higher in the following years. And since you're not seeing those adjustments in this spreadsheet that were done through language, that established a higher base, which Minnesota Management and Budget then included as a higher figure in the future years. So for example, I believe on line 37, I'm not exactly sure if this was one of those instances, but we did some computer replacement for the BCA in previous years, and we gave them appropriations in the biennium that we were appropriating for that were smaller than the tails that we allocated in the budget riders in the bill.
Clear as mud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's still a bit confusing to have a 20% increase with not understanding where it comes from. I mean, I understand $1 million here, $1 million there, but when you get to $8 million, that all of a sudden I just want to know why. I'm not saying that there's anything unusual happening here. It's just whenever we see that, I think it's important to understand. I mean, when we look at the fire marshals in the Board of Firefighter Training, we see a drop in the fire marshal from almost $21 million down to just over 12, but we also see the new training account of $10 million. So that's easy to sort of understand how that's being taken care of. So I always just sort of, when I see large changes, I radar goes off, and I just want to know why.
Mr. Walsh.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dean, I will look into the past bills in the rider language and get back to you on what the reason for that increase is.
Thank you.
Is that it?
Just a few.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative O'Neill.
I don't have a question, but I wanted to point out line 184, which is the Alternatives to Incarceration Grant Program, even though it's not listed as such. It says other local grants. And so I just wanted to point that out, that with a very small amount of money, they had a 61% reduction in recidivism, which is really through the chart. So I just wanted to point out that line that we should, we'll work collectively to hopefully bump that up just a little bit so we can have more folks not return back to prison.
It looks like a very good investment on my part. Any other questions or observations? All right. If not, then thank you, Mr. Waltz, for the walkthrough. And we have an application. With that, we have House File 591, Representative Edelson. Representative Adelson, thank you for the wonderful donuts. They didn't distract me at all from Mr. Walz's.
Well, I was saying that it's not really fair after lunch to bring the snacks as a freshman, but I'm glad that Representative Johnson, I think, and Chair, thank you for eating them. Members, Chair, I motion to hear House Bill 591 and adopt amendment, the DE1 amendment, which all of you, I believe, have copies of now. Okay. I'm seeing nodding heads, so I'm going to go with a yes.
Just to make sure we all have the amendments set. Okay, very well. So Representative Adelson moves House File 591 be laid over for possible inclusion. And Representative Adelson also moves the DE1 delete everything amendment, which puts the bill in the shape that she wishes it to be before us. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
All same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Adelson, your bill is shaped up the way you want it.
Well, very good. Thank you. Chair, committee members, my name's Heather Adelson. I sit on this committee with you. It's interesting to be up here. Very exciting. I'm the representative for Edina, and it is my honor to propose this piece of legislation to you today. House File 591 makes kids visible. What this legislation explicitly does is during a court proceeding directs the courts to ask that the defendant is a parent, guardian, or caregiver to a minor child. And if the defendant is a primary caregiver and the defendant faces a term of imprisonment, the judge may, in their discretion, request the probation officer to complete a family impact statement for the purpose of providing the court with a sentencing option other than a term of imprisonment. The family impact statement includes the relationship between the defendant and child, the impact of the financial needs of the child, the availability of the community and family to support the child, and the likely impact on the child's health, safety, emotional well-being, and education. This legislation gives the court important information to consider when they are making decisions. Oftentimes, what happens to a child is not the primary concern in these sort of court proceedings. But children of incarcerated parents suffer. The data shows that children of incarcerated parents experience significant hardships that lead to an increase in mental health disorders, anxiety, depression, housing instability, behavioral acting out, and academic decline. Among many other concerns, including adding to their ACEs, adverse childhood experiences, which we know have lasting damaging impact on kids. When the court has to make complex decisions at sentencing, it should be armed with as much knowledge as possible. This bill would be a step in the right direction to ensure that children and other families impacted are considered in that decision. Children may be only 20% of our population, but I promise each and every one of you, they are 100% of our future. Chair and committee members, I am honored to have several testifiers here today. And I'd also like to do just a note in your packet. I have a letter in support from Ryan Gary from the Minnesota Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. I also have a letter in support from Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman. And the third letter will actually be read on testimony. We had made to do a copy, and you might have one, but it's not readable. So I'm going to go ahead and call Judy Matanich up to testify first.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Matanich. And let me, as you come forward, perhaps you can spell your name out for the record so that we make sure we get it correctly in the minutes. That'd be terrific. Thank you. Welcome.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Julie Matanich, M-A-T-O-N-I-C-H. And I am a Minnesota attorney, and I'm also currently the chair of the board of a Minnesota nonprofit, Children of Incarcerated Caregivers. Children of Incarcerated Caregivers, or CIC, is a Minnesota nonprofit organization that was founded in 2015 to promote the well-being of children impacted by the incarceration of a parent or other caregiver. Recognizing the devastating consequences that parental incarceration can have on children, CIC works with advanced researchers to determine the needs of these children and then collaborates with decision makers and community leaders to develop resources that support the children and their families. Through its research, CIC identified the use of family impact statements at sentencing as a way to make the needs of the children visible to judges, lawyers, and probation officers when a parent or caregiver is being sentenced. CIC researchers found that international governing bodies and organizations have called for courts to consider the interests of children every time a parent or caregiver faces imprisonment. National associations, including the National Conference of State Legislators, and decision makers in other states and cities have recommended or implemented the use of family impact statements before sentencing as a way to make the courts aware of the needs of these children. Based on its findings, CIC urges the Minnesota legislature to pass the proposed legislation before you today to encourage the use of family impact statements. This legislation would not diminish the court's discretion to impose proportionate sentences. Rather, it would provide important and relevant information to help courts make decisions in the best interests of children, families, and the community at large. It would encourage courts in appropriate cases to consider community-based sentencing alternatives and supervision that strengthen families and enable defendants to uphold their responsibilities to children in order to minimize collateral harm to those children. We received a letter today from Dr. Helen Kim of the Hennepin County Mother Baby Program, and because it's difficult to read, Representative Edelson has asked me to read it aloud to you. To the House of Representatives of Minnesota State Capitol, I am the director of the Mother Baby Program and Red Leaf Center for Family Healing at Hennepin Healthcare. Our mission is to save and improve lives by supporting the emotional health and parenting capacity of pregnant women and mothers of young children. Since 2013, we have served over 500 mothers in our intensive mental health program and helped over 2,000 callers to our Hope Line. It is from this experience with mothers, children, and families that I write now in strong support for the proposed legislation to add family impact statement as a consideration in sentencing. In our experience, we have seen that growing up with an incarcerated parent is common among our population of pregnant and postpartum mothers with depression and other forms of mental illness. Recently, we surveyed a group of our mother-baby program patients and found that 16% acknowledged growing up with a parent who was incarcerated. Of note, there were significant racial disparities within this group. 10% of white women had a parent incarcerated, while 38% of black women and 16% of women identified as non-black, non-white. Among these mothers, the childhood hardship of having a parent incarcerated co-occurred with other adverse childhood experiences, including living in poverty and in an unsafe neighborhood. This pileup of childhood adversity negatively impacted the trajectory of their lives, financially destabilized their families, and undermined their ability to succeed in school and at work. In addition, as adult survivors of the trauma of parental incarceration, the mothers we serve often struggle to provide consistent nurturance and protection that their children need. This repetition of negative parenting practices is part of the generational transmission of trauma. These long-term negative impacts on adult health and functioning, including struggles with parenting, have been affirmed in numerous studies of adverse childhood experiences. By reducing or minimizing the impact of ACEs, including parental incarceration, on the children, and by investing in parents, we can help them be the nurturing and protective adults their children need them to be. Building parent capacity is essential to disrupting the cycle that keeps some families, generation after generation, mired in a web of poverty, family dysfunction, and system involvement with child protection, corrections, mental health, and social services. This proposed family impact statement will make children visible to the court. This is an essential step in acknowledging and minimizing the unintended impact of parental incarceration on children and families. Minimizing separation of parents, allowing incarcerated parents to stay engaged with their children, and supporting children and families experiencing the trauma of having an incarcerated parent are all important considerations at the time of sentencing. Thank you, and please contact me if you have any questions or comments. Sincerely, Helen Kim, MD, Director, Mother Baby Program, and Red Leaf Center for Family Healing, Hennepin Healthcare, Clinical Assistant Professor of Psychiatry, University of Minnesota.
Thank you, Ms. Mantinich.
Thank you, Julie, for your testimony.
And, Representative Nelson, we'll take all your testifiers and then
perfect.
Open up the questions.
Thank you, Chair. I'd like to next call up, and Julie will remain at the testifiers table with me. I'd like to call next Judge Wernick.
Good afternoon, Judge. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mark Wernick. Last name is spelled W-E-R-N-I-C-K.
Welcome, Mr.
Thank you.
Judge Wernick.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name, again, Mark Wernick. I am a retired Hennepin County District Court judge, having served in that capacity from 2002 to 2014. From 2008 to 2012, I was the presiding judge. That means like the managing judge of the criminal division of the Hennepin County District Court. I am now on senior status. That means I am eligible to hear cases still on a per diem basis. I am also a member of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. I was appointed to the commission in 2015 by Governor Dayton. My term expired in January of 2019, along with Governor Dayton's term, but I still do serve on the commission until Governor Walz appoints my replacement. I have not re-upped for a new term. I am here in my personal capacity. I am not representing the Guidelines Commission. I'd like to begin by explaining how this bill relates to the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines. The guidelines, as I'm sure you know, directs judges to impose a sentence within a certain range based on the severity of the offense and the defendant's criminal history. That range is called the presumed sentence. If the judge imposes a sentence other than the presumed sentence, that's called a departure, and the judge must justify the departure either in writing or on the record. Generally speaking, in order to depart from a sentence that is presumptively a prison sentence, in other words, in order to depart from prison to probation, the judge must make a finding that the defendant is particularly amenable to probation. Particularly amenable means especially amenable or unusually amenable. Judges can consider the defendant's age, prior record, expressions of remorse, cooperation with authorities, attitude while in court, and the defendant's support system of family and friends. In addition, the judge must consider the impact on public safety by putting the defendant on probation rather than in prison. Minnesota appellate courts often say that departure for probation in a presumptive prison case, a departure for probation must be not only good for the defendant, but it must be good for society. With respect to family considerations, or the consideration of children especially, the Minnesota appellate courts have said that the defendant's obligations to minor dependents may reflect on the defendant's amenability to probation. A defendant who is needed by minor dependents for financial or emotional support, that defendant may be particularly motivated to comply with the rules of probation so that probation becomes good for the defendant and good for the minor dependents. This bill does two things. First, by directing the sentencing judge to inquire about a defendant's status as a caregiver, this bill alerts the judge to the important issues involving incarcerated defendants who have dependent children. Second, in cases involving a possible prison sentence, it opens up the pre-sentence investigation process to allow for a family impact statement. By having this information come from a probation officer, and certainly with the help of the defendant, rather than just from the defendant, the court is best assured that its sentencing decision will be based on reliable family impact information. I recognize that requiring or asking a probation officer to do a family impact statement, that's going to have a workload effect on the probation staff. In my experience, at least in Hennepin County, probation officers already describe in their pre-sentence investigation reports what the defendant's family background is, including information on parents, children, and significant others. Most of this information is provided to the probation officer by the defendant during the interview process, and then the probation officer can go and verify information where he or she thinks appropriate. The family impact statement requires, in my view, another layer of analysis, but it doesn't create a whole new inquiry that the probation officer was not going to otherwise do. Also, judges can screen out frivolous requests for family impact statements. If this were my court, I would require a defense lawyer, before I would order such an impact statement, I'd require the defense lawyer to make some preliminary plausible showing that a family impact statement is going to help me make the decision that the defendant is asking me to make. Finally, I would note that oftentimes defense lawyers will do almost all the legwork on this issue. They will gather all the facts necessary for the judge to make a family impact statement, and here the probation officer would simply have to verify that the information is true for the judge and then offer their analysis as well. So that is what I think this statute does.
Judge, thank you for that. Was a very helpful walkthrough. I had all sorts of questions about, so what's currently happening, you know, what are informal processes? And so you were able to provide both some the practice as well as the concepts behind the current practices and therefore the setup for this particular proposal. I really appreciate that. If you can stick around for possible questions, I would greatly appreciate it, Judge.
Thank you.
Thank you, Judge. Thank you, Chair. I would like to now call up Dr. Rebecca Schlafer, and she's from the University of Minnesota Medical School.
Welcome to the committee, Dr. Schlafer.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House File 591. My name is Rebecca Schlafer, and I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Minnesota's Medical School. My background is in developmental child psychology and maternal and child public health. My research and teaching at the university focus on the intersections of incarceration and health, and I'm a national expert on the impact of incarceration on children and families. Stories are powerful, and you'll have an opportunity to hear one of those stories next from Miss Mary Britz. For me, as a scientist and researcher, I want numbers. I want to know just how many stories like Mary's exist. But Minnesota, like many other states in the country, does not systematically track the number of parents who are incarcerated or the number of children who are impacted. And so in 2014, I worked closely with the Minnesota Department of Corrections to develop a study to do just that. Now, our state has some of the best data in the country on this issue. From this study, we learned that two-thirds of men in prison are fathers with minor children, and more than half of them lived with one of their children prior to their arrest. Among incarcerated women, three-quarters are mothers with minor children, and the majority lived with their children prior to arrest. And so, on any given day, there are more than 16,000 Minnesota children that are separated from their parents because their parents are in prison. My colleagues and I also advocated to have a question added to the 2013 Minnesota Student Survey. From that survey, we found that 1 in 6 Minnesota youth has a history of parental incarceration. Further, we found that Minnesota youth with a history of parental incarceration fared worse than their peers on every single measure of health and development. They were more likely to be depressed, skip school, use drugs, and be engaged in violence. We know that the separation of parents and children is traumatic and can have lifelong consequences on children's health and development. My hope is that this legislation gives judges and key decision makers the information they need to make the best decisions to support Minnesota children and families. Do those 16,000 Minnesota children need to be separated from their parents? Or can we identify alternatives to incarceration that hold parents accountable and don't unnecessarily separate children from their parents? Thank you for the opportunity to testify today, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Dr. Schlafer. If you could also stick around, that'd be great. But I just want to very quickly make sure I heard this correct. You said one in six youth?
That's correct. From the Minnesota Student Survey, which is a survey of 5th, 8th, 9th, and 11th graders in our state and is administered every 3 years, that question about parental incarceration was asked of the 8th, 9th, and 11th graders. And they're asked specifically about whether or not they've ever had a parent or guardian in jail or prison. And so that 1 in 6 statistic is about any history of incarceration, and it's about 2% of Minnesota youth who have a parent currently incarcerated, and 1 in 6 who have any history of incarceration. It's staggering.
All right, thank you. We do have questions, but I'm going to hold off for the other two witnesses, as I said
earlier. And the doctor is going to stay as well.
Circle around. If anyone needs to leave, let me know, because we'll pull you back up to the testifiers table as quickly as possible. Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Chair. I have two more testifiers. And thank you, Doctor. So my next testifier is Mary Britz. She's the executive director of the Blaisdell YMCA, and she's going to give us personal testimony of her experience in this matter.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Britz.
Thank you for having me here, Chair and committee. My name is Mary Britz, B-R-I-T-T-S, and I'm the executive director of the Blaisdell YMCA. But today I'm going to talk about, excuse me, a personal friend of mine. I met this family about 15 years ago, and her middle daughter and my daughter were AAU basketball companions, and they were, yes, definitely Division I hopefuls. They played all of their AAU together from their fourth grade year all the way up until their senior year of high school. In 2011, they both graduated, and in 2012, her mother was incarcerated. Her daughter, which she has three, the oldest daughter was out on her own, the middle daughter was, going on to St. Thomas. She got a full ride academic. She was a 4.0 student and was on the National Honor Society. School was her first love. The youngest daughter was going into her sophomore year of high school. The middle child ended up dropping out of school and went home, went back to the house to try to save the house and work full time. That lasted about 3 years or 3 months. And I stepped in and just told her this isn't going to work. So I took both of the girls and they moved in with me. They did lose their home. She was contemplating suicide. The youngest child was very much going through, again, 15 years old, very promiscuous. I was dealing with a lot of gentlemen coming to the house, her coming in at 1 and 2 o'clock in the morning, and her father the family was married back in like 2010 or 11, and they separated due to his, chemical dependency. And so when mother was away, I contacted the father and worked with him for about 6 months to help him get to the point where he can actually participate in his daughter's lives. One of the other things I made sure happened is every Sunday I got the girls together and we went to visit her mom for the 2 years to make sure that they kept a relationship with her. When mom came out, she didn't move in with me. worked with her for 2 years and got her to a point where she was working 2 full-time jobs. And now she has her own place. The middle child is still trying to figure out, you know, where she wants to go at 26 now. She lives in Arizona and working. The younger daughter is here. We did get her through high school. She didn't get pregnant. And just working. But I know right now there is still a lot of resent and harsh feelings between the girls and their mother. So I really thought with all my heart, if something could change where she could have been there, the middle child would have finished college. She was so smart. It would be somewhere in a career. And the younger daughter would be in post-secondary education right now. But I just, and I'm really sorry that I get very emotional about it. It was not an easy time. My daughter was away at college, and I was working with these other two. And it just seems that there could be something I've done differently. And had that mother been a part of those two girls' lives, that their lives would be different today.
Thank you, Ms. Britz. You certainly have our strong sympathies for your personal sense of loss and strong connection with this family. This does speak to collateral consequences of how we administer our laws and, of course, as well, you know, the behaviors of individuals who are, you know, that their behaviors lead them into our correction system. With that, I think you have one more testifier.
I have one more, yes, Chair. And I'm really, so I'm going to, we're going to close with our last testifier. Ramsey County Attorney John Choi has joined us today. Really what I'm trying to do, committee members, is make sure that you hear from every possible aspect of how the law is impacted from persons impacted. So I thank John Choi for joining us, and I look forward to hearing his testimony.
Welcome to the committee, my Ramsey County attorney, Mr. John Choi. It's a pleasure to see you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, and I haven't had a chance to congratulate you on your new role, but congratulations. It's really great to see you there in that spot, and it's great to be here with all of you, to the members of the committee. I'm here today to lend my support to Representative Edelson's bill, House Bill 591, because I think it's an important piece that's been missing for a very long time. As we think about the issues of how an effective criminal justice system should be for the people of Minnesota, I think that this notion that when we make this very huge decision to send someone to prison, we have to come to terms and we have to have a reckoning about the harm that incarceration can also, that can occur to family members and ultimately to our community. And so having a very, very intentional way of getting this information before the court so that it's a consideration as a part of what justice should be in a particular case, I think is an important one. As a part of a criminal prosecution, the prosecutor's job is to represent the state's interests or the people of the state of Minnesota. Oftentimes we say that we represent the victim, but technically we represent the people to ensure that justice is done. And of course a big, big part of what we need to do is to do right by those who have been harmed. And as a part of the prosecution, that's what that is all about. But when we get to a point where there has been a conviction, and the question is about what is the appropriate sentence. And oftentimes our society for a very long time, we have focused very much on punishment. And we do ultimately what we think the people want us to do. But I think as more and more people have become attuned to the things that happen in our criminal justice system and how we can make it better, these types of thoughts or ways of thinking about incarceration, I think, are really, really critical. And so what this bill does, in my opinion, is that it intentionally puts it into that process so that the people that ultimately have to make that decision, which are the judges in the sentencing area, that they're going to be thinking about this. And it's not to mitigate or undo any harm to the victim. What it's doing is to ensuring that the quality of justice in our community and our future is being thought through as well. Because the information that was presented earlier, it is true. It is very true that when parents, caregivers are sent to prison, there is harm that is done to the kids of those parents. And we need to, I think, better understand that and have a process by which we think about that. And at the end of the day, I think if we think about some of the negative and bad things about the criminal justice system, I see so many people and families who cycle through over and over and over again. And we kind of do the same thing over and over again. It's the definition of insanity. We kind of want different results, but we're not necessarily getting it. And so this is an opportunity, I think, as a state, to express some values that I think are fundamental to all of us here in this room. So I encourage all of you to support this bill.
Thank you, County Commissioner Choi. I appreciate the encouragement for us to be inclusive and expand the notion of justice. And the way you framed this up in terms of obviously always paying attention to justice for the victim and understanding that there's also justice for the people generally. And of course, as Ms. Britz, very eloquently and powerfully put, there's a human face when it comes to impact on all members of the community, including family members, including minors. So thank you for your approach and your advice here. Representative Edelson, at this point I would say we'll open it up for questions. Is that?
Yes, Chair, I'm ready to open it up for questions.
Very well. We do have several questions from members. Representative Nash, welcome. I trust you are okay. I heard you had a mishap.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes,
it's good to see you.
I was one of the folks that suffered both a break in the ice due to the freezing temperatures and then fell on Monday and on the ice and got pretty beat up. But nonetheless, we're back. We're good. To the author, a couple questions. The judge that you had earlier said that there's going to be a significant impact to the workload. I think he said workload implications for those that are going to be doing these statements. And I looked through the packet. I didn't see a fiscal note of any kind. I don't know if you had requested one. But according to your own testifier, there's going to be now more work that is a result of this. And obviously more work is going to result in a fiscal impact. Did you request a fiscal note that hasn't come or?
Chair, Representative Nash, the judge, I don't know that he said that. So we can call him back up here and just get clarity around that. Judge Wernick, are you here? Okay.
Why don't we do that in the meantime?
Because with that being said, I will just say that I have been in contact with the DOCCR, the director, CJ, who is in charge of doing these PSI reports. And we have talked through, we will be working together. She's actually coming to my office next week to work through what that's going to look like in terms of workload. Now, Judge Wernick, do you want to just come right back up?
Why don't we do that while the judge comes forward? Send them from our staff fiscal analyst, Mr. Walls, who might have something to add to this conversation.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, I had a conversation with the courts as to whether or not they thought there would be a cost implication. And while they said it's possible, the person I spoke to didn't think there would be a cost on the courts. However, they were going to look into it. They did think there might be an additional workload on probation agents, and so therefore I requested a fiscal note, which has not yet been completed.
Okay. Judge Wernick, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair, what I said was that this does raise probation officer workload issues, and by my examples, I thought that I was minimizing them. I thought that much of this work gets done anyway. It just adds a level of analysis to it, and that much of the raw data gets supplied by the defendant or the defense lawyer.
Very well. concern is.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And as fiscal staff has indicated, that there's a potential for a fiscal impact, and thus you've requested a fiscal note. I think that would be a prudent thing to look at before we were to vote this out of committee, because we are the fiscal committee of jurisdiction on this. And so I'm sure it's being laid over. I'm going to want to make sure that we address that at least. I think that's fair, because if it does have a fiscal impact, that's something that we need to take into consideration. Second question, Mr. Chair, that I had, and I just want to make sure that I get this correct. Let's set up two scenarios. One scenario where there is family involved, and this is a very important issue, and I'm glad you're bringing this so that we can talk about it. But if there's a situation where there is family involved, and then there's a situation where the person who is going to be sentenced has no family at all, isn't that essentially creating two separate outcomes that is going to be created? I mean, so somebody without a family is going to be getting perhaps a harsher sentence than somebody who has family. And I'm just wanting to make sure, because that's something that you didn't bring up, but it's a question that I've got, and it seems that the judge is nodding.
Well, Judge Warnock, I'll let you.
So the guidelines do address this, Mr. Chair, if I may. The guidelines do address this, and you're raising a good point, because there is that tension. So the guidelines say that a judge can't do a downward departure based on the defendant's employment or based on the what the defendant has attained educationally, based on the defendant's marital status, based on the defendant's living arrangements. You can't say this defendant got a great job, I'm not going to send him to prison, or this defendant has a kid, I'm not going to send him to prison. But you can use all these social factors to look at the whole person to see how amenable this person will be to probation. So now the family connections are relevant. So the person without a family certainly can't use that in support of whatever case he or she wants to make for a departure. That person's going to have to describe other things about him or herself. But the whole person is relevant to the question of whether he or she will be particularly amenable to probation. And if I may say that what we're trying to do by saying that you can't consider employment, educational attainment, and so forth, I believe that if you go back to 1978, when the guideline statute was first implemented, everyone was very concerned about not having race discrimination be built into the guidelines. And so they wanted to identify certain factors that are often associated with race, such as education and employment. And then they wanted to say, don't go there. So something like family ties, your need to give emotional support to children, that kind of thing. That has no racial barriers. That's a fair area of inquiry.
So Judge Warnock, the amenable to probation concept remains consistent and still holds as a reason for departure.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I'm
just observing that the amenable to probation concept holds. This is within the scope of that,
yes.
That allowed reason for departure.
Yes.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I want to make sure that I'm hearing this correctly, that somebody who doesn't have family could realistically see a different outcome. I just want to make sure that's we're getting that on the record, because that's something.
Representative Nash, and Chair, Representative Nash.
Mr. Chair, if I could, I know that Representative Edelson is a new member of this, but we have decorum, and we allow that the person who's asking the question first to finish.
Representative Nash, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Edelson, we do have decor here. And when
Nash.
Very well. So I just want to make sure that I get the answer correctly so that I can properly evaluate this and get into a position where I'm prepared to vote in favor or against this this bill. So I would welcome your answer, or the judges, or whomever.
Representative Nash.
Members. The procedure is to go through the chair.
Yes, it is.
We are involved in legislation that folks and ideas feel very strongly about and passionately about. And so obviously we're going to conduct ourselves in a manner where we're going to give each other some room for that passion to come forward. But at no time do I expect any of you to bypass the chair in that conversation. That applies to both sides of the aisle. So let's take a deep breath and let's talk about the substance before us. Representative Ellison.
Chair, Representative Nash, I would also say that socioeconomic indications of how those also come into play, and that's not necessarily fair either, but I would encourage the judge to hear your perspective.
Judge Warrick.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nash, I think you're merely stating the obvious. It's just somebody who doesn't have minor dependents is not going to be able to make an argument that they ought to stay out of prison because they have minor dependents. I mean, it's just another fact judges consider. There's lots of facts. So I don't think this unfairly discriminates against people who don't have children. It's good for people who do.
Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani. One of the questions I do have dealt with the survey of the kids that were in school. The question I have is, they said 1 in 6, which is 16% of the state population, roughly. We have more people spending one night in jail for a DWI than we have going into our state prison system. I guess the next time I'd like to actually find out the numbers, how many were in county time doing short time for something stupid, getting drunk and getting into a bar fight. You end up going to the night in jail, and then when you get bailed out the next day when you go to court, a few weeks later you pay your ticket and be done. Compared to actually some of the serious crimes that we put them into the state prison system, because there's a huge difference there. But there's also consequences for that. And I'm concerned about the departures we're talking about here that Representative Nash brought up. I don't believe if you actually look in 1978 when the sentencing guidelines was started, and I wish Nathan Ritz was here from the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. He could answer some more questions, but I do not see him here. That was set up to stop and try to alleviate sentencing disparities. It's done a good job, but unfortunately the departures that judges are doing are causing even more disparity in the sentencing. But I understand the idea behind this bill, but I do believe it's the wrong approach, because it doesn't matter who you are, whether you're affluent, whether you're not. Everybody should be treated the same when it comes to our prison system. There shouldn't be favorites. Everybody should be treated the same. This changes things again, and I don't think it's going to even fall in the sentencing guidelines. When you start doing departures, it creates more problems. In Minnesota, we already have one of the lowest incarcerations in the state, or in the country. We average 47, 48, and we've been as high as 49 in the lowest amount of time incarceration. And the other thing that bothers me on this bill.
Representative Johnson, I apologize for interrupting. We are in questioning a period with our testifiers. And so there's a question that I would really appreciate if you get to it quickly.
I do have one question that I'd like to finish up where I was going. The one thing is, yes, are those kids victims of the system? Absolutely. But you're missing a lot of other victims that I don't think you thought about. The victims of rape, the victims of murder.
Senator Johnson.
Those victims are just as important.
Representative Johnson.
And they're not being answered here.
Representative Johnson, I would ask that you not question the motives members here.
Chair Mariani, I'm speaking for those victims.
The question here is not what the representative has not thought about. The question before the table is the proposal itself, and I would greatly appreciate if you get to a question on that proposal. We have three other members who have questions. We also have another bill, and there are members of the public who may want to testify on this bill. So if you can work along with the chair here and get us quickly to the work we should be doing right now, which is to ask these witnesses, while we have them, questions in order to clarify our decisions on this bill. I appreciate it.
I'm trying to remember the question I had. I was going in a line, and you interrupted me. I'll see if I can remember what the question was, but like I said.
Please, Mr. Johnson, Representative Johnson, thank you.
Yep, we do need to be concerned about the actual victims of the crime as well.
Thank you. I didn't hear a question there. Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So pleased to hear that our system is so equitable at this point. Representative, if you would set aside your state representative hat for a minute, put on your therapist hat, could you address some of the impacts on the children, please?
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair Considine. I'm a child that had a parent that was incarcerated. My mom got into a drunk driving accident where somebody was not hurt, but it was still not a great situation. And I became housing instable after that. My mom went to the workhouse for three months. And after, we had no money. And our life fell apart. My life fell apart. So this piece of legislation is not to Representative Johnson. So some of the things that you're saying, I want to make sure that the judge addresses this. I'm thinking about amenability to probation. There are people that are falling through the cracks right now that can be helped by other means, and we're letting them fall through. I am one of the people that made it through, though I will tell you it was dicey and it was hard. I did, and so this legislation does mean something to me personally. Judge, can you tell me in what instance that you would actually downward depart? Because I want to make sure that we're addressing Chair Johnson's question, which I believe was making sure that we're not letting rapists and violent offenders out.
Judge Werner.
Yes, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. So there are some offenses where you can't depart to probation. So, for example, there's mandatory minimums. So in some of the top drug offenders, also in any offense involving a firearm where there's been a prior conviction of a firearm, judges can't depart. But I just have to emphasize the public safety part of it. So if you have the more serious the offense, even if a defendant is particularly amenable to probation, if it's a very serious offense, the judge has to consider, well, I can't depreciate the seriousness of the offense by putting this guy on probation. It's so serious that the crime just calls for a prison sentence. And so that's the process that the judges go through. I'll just say that historically, you see about 18,000 offenses a year being sentenced in Minnesota. This is 2017. About 6,000 of them are presumptive prison sentences. Those presumptive prison sentences can be anywhere, you know, anything from really serious to just not that serious. And I can go for examples if you want. But of those 6,000 cases, there's about a 35% departure rate where the defendant gets probation. So that's the overall rate. How many of those involve family members we don't keep track of data for? So the departure rate has been that for years and years. That number stays pretty solid. And so that's what it is. But the more serious of the offense is, the less likely you're going to see that kind of departure. You're going to see a lot of them in drug cases, a lot of them in the DWI cases. On the low-level assaults cases, not involving a firearm, we see a lot of departures for probation. But that's my answer.
Very well. Representative Mulder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to piggyback off that, because I had some concerns about this bill when I first saw it, too. And Judy, I thank you, and I'm sorry I don't remember your last name.
Julie Mathich,
thank you. We talked about this, and one of the things we talked about was how case law already allows for some of these factors to be considered when you're talking about particular amenability to probation. And I looked up the guidelines commentary, and 2D303 of the guidelines commentary talks about those cases at State v. Soto. And so that was very helpful for me to understand that we were talking only about dispositional departures. We're not talking about downward durational departures. This is only dispositional departures. Case law does allow some of this. It just makes it much clearer here and then provides some direction with respect to the pre-sentence investigation information. Am I correct about that?
Judge?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Judge Warren.
You are absolutely correct on that. The thrust of my testimony was that this bill does nothing to change the court's authority under the guidelines. It is simply designed to give the judge better information.
Senator Baldwin.
Yep, Mr. Chair, I have one more question, and that has to do with the question about workload issues that was raised for probation. And there's some information that courts and probation already collect when someone comes into the system, like if they're eligible for public defender services, for bail, things like that. And I'm wondering if some of that information that's collected early on can then be helpful to probation as they're figuring out family impact here.
Judge Warren.
Mr. Chair. So in Hennepin County, we do bail evaluations on all felony offenses, and the bail evaluations have some of this information in it. The bail evaluation does go to the court file, but it does go to the probation file if we send it in for a pre-sentence investigation report. So your answer is yes, that information is available. Probation will still do the entire workup interview with the defendant.
Representative Mueller, it seems to me that the dispositional departure framework is really consistent with the approach that we're trying to advance here. So we're not touching, the serious, danger to public safety. We're working with that, what we've recognized, it seems to me, with this, to really advance this idea of a community-centered public safety framework in our state. Representative Pinto, and then Representative Howard. Okay. All right, Representative Howard.
Thank you, Chair. Just a quick question that relates in somewhat to Representative Nash's comments that, we want everybody treated equally. And to me, and part of that question presumes that right now everyone's been being treated equally. And I think we see in Minnesota and throughout the country huge racial disparities in our criminal justice system. And just wanted to call attention to the handout, and I believe these are national statistics, that 1 in 9 African-American children have a parent in prison, 1 in 28 Hispanic children, 1 in 57 white children. And I'm just wondering if the author or some of the testifiers would comment on the racial equity component of this bill, and it's important in a state, Minnesota, which we talk about our rankings, we are ranked in the very top of states in terms of racial disparities in our country. And this bill, to me, seems like a good bill to address our racial equity gaps, and would just ask for comment from the author or testifiers.
Representative Adelson.
Chair, Representative Howard, I would ask that Dr. Schlafer rejoin us at the table as she's an expert in this area.
There are multiple chairs there, so we're going to perhaps the testifiers can hang around nearby. Dr. Schlafer.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think that this is a really important point. And while our state does rank one of the lowest in terms of incarceration rates in this country, we have some of the worst disparities in the country. For example, one of the programs that I work closely with is the Minnesota Prison Doula Project. We provide support to pregnant women in prison. Despite the fact that Native American women make up less than 1% of our state's population, they are 25% of the pregnant women who come to prison. Parental incarceration is an adverse childhood experience, and we know that it is connected to other adverse childhood experiences, right? Parental substance abuse, parental mental health problems, separation from the parent. And we know that this constellation of ACEs is what perpetuates inequities across generations. So when kids have an incarcerated parent and they carry all this other adversity and this risk with them, we are starting them off, for those pregnant moms and those babies, from the very start we are starting them off on an unequal footing. My hope is that this bill will help us consider parenting and alternatives to incarceration so that parents can be together. It doesn't mean that that parent isn't accountable. It is that we are minimizing the separation between parents and children so that parents can get support for what they need in the community to be better parents, to be safer citizens, and that their children are not disproportionately impacted.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Howard. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm going to give some personal testimony here and then ask a question, because when I was younger and I was arrested and I went through the court system, they did my pre-sentence investigation and they considered my home situation, they considered my parents' situation in relationship to me when considering my sentence. And it sort of seems to me that the reverse should be true, too, that when parents are in a situation where kids are involved, that the kids are an important part of a family. And I would think that although they may not give the educational support or the other types of things, but that emotional support that kids bring to parents, I think would be really, really important on them moving forward and operating in a different framework in life. So I'm curious why, I mean, I love this bill. I've signed on this bill. I think it's a great bill. I think we need to do this bill. But there's a part of me that wonders why the people that do pre-sentence investigations already aren't taking this into consideration. And I'll just, for the record, I want to say that, you know, there's a lot of May in here. So it's not like we're forcing people to do certain types of preparing of reports. This is really suggestive language to try to change a system that may not be considering something that should be considered. So if someone, I don't know if it's the judge or who it might be, could talk about why this isn't already being done.
Welcome back, Judge Werdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Dean, in my experience in Hennepin County, where we do pre-sentence investigation reports, they almost do this. So the judge gets the raw data on children and who are they living with and what kind of support does the defendant give the children. But it doesn't, in my recollection, it doesn't go kind of the extra step as to what's going to be the impact when you remove the defendant from the scene, and then how are we going to make up for whatever, you know, responsibilities the defendant has. So we're adding that extra step. And I would say also that the law in this area, the idea that we look to the interests of children to sentence a defendant. You know, there's only a handful of cases that have gone to the appellate courts about this. They've all said that the courts can look to the impact on children, but it's still a little bit counterintuitive for a lot of practitioners. And they say it's just, you know, it's just about the defendant, and if two defendants commit the same crime, they ought to get the exact same sentence, and you don't get into the nuances of their lives. And so it's just the way it is. And that's why I think legislation would help move the ball along and get judges thinking about this more and get the defense lawyers thinking about it more.
Chairman D.
Thank you, Judge Warnick. And, you know, I just for the record, my offense was before there was a sentencing guideline. So the judge had the opportunity to do a downward departure. And, you know, ultimately, there are times when our criminal justice system does work, and there are many times when it doesn't work, or at least it has very much unintended consequences. So I want to thank you for your testimony, and I especially want to thank Ms. Britz for your testimony. It illustrates, unfortunately, situations that are out there. And if we're not addressing those situations just because we're blind to it, I think that that's a little bit on us, but it's also important that the public testify to us and let us know those things that are really happening on the ground. So thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll end my question.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative David. And Judge Warnock, just again, I want to be clear. It's a good conversation. As a judge, would you read this language as not holding someone accountable? I know it's sort of like perhaps one of those dull questions, but I think it's important as a practitioner, as a judge, to share with us, whether anything in this language produces a situation where we're not holding folks accountable.
Mr. Chair, I'd answer it this way. The legislation is really neutral on whether or not any particular defendant should go to prison or get probation. The legislation is just about giving relevant information, making sure relevant information gets to the judge. Once the relevant information gets to the judge may very well say, these kids would be better off with the defendant in prison. So, you know, it can go either way.
Very well. Thank you. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I guess my question is to the bill author. So it was last year or the year before, I had the opportunity to spend some time with Hennepin County family law judges, and the stories that they were telling, it was just heartbreaking, the impact of to children, of the ordeals that the judges have to deal with. And the judges were explaining it was sometimes the parents are in and out of all kinds of circumstances that simply have a negative impact on children, negative influence. And it was, again, just heart-wrenching to hear some of these stories. So one of the things that's very concerning to me is what is the influence that parents have that might be engaged in negative behaviors onto the children? And so as I'm reading this bill language, I'm seeing the report is to go into and attempt to quantify the impact to a child's health, the safety, the emotional well-being, and the education. And I guess my question is, will the report also quantify the potential adverse impact, the negative impact of continuing a parent that is engaging in negative behaviors that would, again, have a negative influence on the children?
Representative Adelson.
Chair, Representative Lucero, I think to what the judge said just a moment ago, working as somebody that's been guardian ad litem with Hennepin County, I've seen exactly what you're talking about, and there are situations that kids are in that are terrible situations. And in that situation, I do believe that that family impact statement would capture a lot of that, to the judge's point, where the judge may not, there was some, actually, Rebecca, we should probably talk about this, there was some question as to if the information gathered in family impact statement could actually hurt the defendant, because what if they are not? But the reality is I think that going to helping the judge, there is the very, to be very clear, the judge, there's a shall and there's a may. The shall is to ask if there's a minor child. The may is the judge may take that in consideration. The judge may not. Right now, the judge, I think it's just better to have a judge making decisions that are more informed. And so I do think that some of that information is going to be captured. Judge, do you have anything?
Thank you. Just a more of a quick follow-up comment, and I hope that's right if this language does move forward, because it is my high concern, just reading the language here, that it would not necessarily capture that information, my concern with the language as it's written is that it would not do that. And I know much of the conversation as I've been listening has been surrounding how will the children, should the, this is geared towards, I'm getting the impression it's geared towards having the parent who's committed or has been convicted more in the child's life. And I'm not convinced that's healthy in many cases. And I just want to make sure that it is captured, because the as you were talking about perpetuating generational stuff, we need to remove parents out of the influences of their children in some of these cases, again, as the conversations from the family court that I was hearing. So, yeah, thank you.
Chair, I would love to. I would call on Dr. Schley to Schlafer. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, thank you for that. I'm also a guardian ad litem in Hennepin County, and I'd like to share a brief story with you about a case that I just recently had. A father was convicted of criminal sexual conduct on his teenage daughter and got 17 years in prison. And I think we can all agree that that father going to prison and not being in that household is what was best for that child. And yet this case really stirred up for me so much about the collateral consequences of incarceration, because that dad was the sole breadwinner for that family. This family, mom didn't work. She was actively involved in their faith community but had no income, and every single benefit that was coming to that family was tied to the father. And so on one hand, this father's incarceration helped protect that child. And on the other hand, it set in motion this domino effect of financial instability for the family. I don't think that a judge in this case, with additional information, would have made any different decision about that father going to prison. What could happen, though, potentially, is with additional information, a probation officer could say, whoa, this family is now in a heap of financial trouble. Maybe we can connect mom to some additional resources or get her some job training so that she can get some support for this family. Dad does need to go to prison. That child needs to be safe. And yet, there were still negative consequences for that family that really resulted in that now teenage daughter working 20 hours a week while taking classes at the U at Menards to make money for her family, because she was now the sole breadwinner for her family at 17 years old. So I don't think that in a case like that, a judge would make any different decision, but I think it gives the judge additional information to make an informed decision, and I think that's a good thing.
Thank you, Dr. Schlafer, for a very good description of what I think community center public safety is about in terms of the wholeness of the community, in this case, the wellness of the other parent and their child. Representative Johnson, we have a few minutes, and then we'll move the way over to Bill.
Chair Mariani, I don't know if the judge could answer this question or not.
Judge Werdick.
One thing you're talking about, the doing a family impact statement in the PSI. I'm just wondering if they do a victim impact statement in the PSI dealing with the family from the victims.
Judge Werdick. And, Judge, as you come forward, before we run out of time, I do want to invite you to return next week when we'll have hearings that address the sentencing guidelines. So we have a couple of bills directed, and okay. We'd love to have your presence.
Thank you. Thank you.
Representative Werner.
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, pre-sentence investigation reports do have victim impact sections.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson, we're going to still try to squeeze in Representative Grosso.
Yep. We'll do that real quick. Where I was going to go, what Dr. Schlafer said, it was interesting what she was saying, but I think I understand the intent of this bill, but I think what we should be looking at is coming up with programs to help these kids and make sure that the community is safe. And if we get some programs to help these kids and those families that are in trouble because of what the suspect did, especially like raping his own daughter, that person, as far as I'm concerned, should be, if he never sees the light of day, it would be too good. But we do need to come up with some programs to help those individuals and those families of these, and the families of those that break the law and have to suffer the consequences so those families don't suffer. Not reduce the consequences because they have families, but everybody should be treated the same. That's what the sentencing guidelines has done. And I do have to say that, yes, judges, even when there's mandatory minimums with a firearm, judges do depart them. I had a judge in my county do a departure instead of a two-year minimum. He did 364 days. It cost my county over $750,000 to house that prisoner because of the medical needs instead of going to the state correction system where they had the facilities to take care of them.
So, Johnson, I think we heard testimony that this proposal is within the sentencing guideline principles that have been laid out for a number of years. Representative Grosso, real quick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just listening to this today, I just have to ask, some of the questions were already asked. As far as your experience, Doctor, with the parents committing felonies, I mean, is there any information out there, the kind of effect that has on the kids, whatever type of felonies that are being committed? Because in my experience as a law enforcement officer, I mean, I dealt with generation after generation after generation, and it didn't matter the color of the person's skin. The crimes that were being committed, that's what I saw. I dealt with grandpa, I dealt with dad, and I dealt with son later. So, I mean, these impacts, you know, it's this is a good thing to take a good hard look at, but these impacts are, you know, is there anything out there on that?
Schlaefer, quickly, please.
Mr. Chair, I think we know that not all felonies are created equally, correct? And that many of the things that bring people into criminal court are also things that compromise child well-being, right? So parent substance use, dangerous involvement in crime, right? Those are things that both drive one's involvement in the criminal justice system and can compromise child well-being. And so I think that one of the real challenges that we have is how do we break that cycle? We know that the separation of the parent going to prison has collateral consequences for the child's well-being across their life. At what point do we figure out how to keep parents in the community, provide support for the parent and the family so that the next generation doesn't come back in?
Representative Edelson, 30 seconds, and then we're going to lay this over. And the chair would certainly appreciate your reflection on the notion of community-centered public safety relative to this bill.
I had one more, just one short.
Representative Grassel, we're going to have to move. I apologize. We're already 5 minutes over. I just want to have her have a few seconds, and then we're going to lay the bill over.
Thank you, Chair. I know that this is this strikes chords with lots of different people. Are we being not tough on crime? Are we letting people off that shouldn't be? But the reality is, as Dr. Schlaefer really did testify, to the reason that this bill was drafted is because right now, even the director of the DOCCR said that this could be helpful, that there is a missing piece here. And so this legislation goes to try to fix that, goes to try to make sure that we're looking at the implication and trying to stop this cycle that we see. One in six. And, you know, there's just so many impacts with this. So I just I hope that we can have this bill laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
And we will do that. We'll have the bill back before us. And so Representative Grassel will continue the conversation at that point. I do want to thank all the testifiers, Ms. Matinich, Judge Wernick, Dr. Schlaefer, Ms. Britz, and our county attorney in Ramsey, John Choi. And at this point, House File 591 is laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. And members, until tomorrow at the same time, this committee stands adjourned.
Question for you, Mr. Chair.
What's
that? Just a quick question for you.
Yes.
Is there going to be a fiscal note to look for on this?
We're definitely going to explore that. I think we heard from staff that we're going to vet a few things. And so when it comes back up, we'll have that.
Thank you.